one with a religious background. I hadn't really thought about it that much until today, which is good. That's why I'm here.
The example you gave this morning, I thought was a fabulous, I mean, it's just embroiled with ethical questions. She brought up that her hospital was involved a couple months before she got on the job, had a mental patient in the hospital who was released, and then
was released and within 24 hours killed his family, the neighbors, and himself.
So is the hospital culpable in that? Yeah, I mean, just the questions involved in that, and what should the hospital's responsibility be, the message to the community? I mean, that's... And the chances of you having to handle something like that again.
Well, what do you communicate?
Yeah, what... Now that you're on the job...
physicians run like hell when that happens.
Is your
nonprofit
organization,
mm-hmm.
is it charitably supported
or
how?
Is
that
a good Sam,
Jane?
No,
it's nonprofit, completely, community hospital.
Okay. It's government then. I mean, is it part of the municipal?
It's a community hospital, nonprofit community hospital. There's a parent organization that really the Good Samaritan founded, and there are three affiliate hospitals. But they're all nonprofit.
But you're still dependent upon raising an income that allows you to continue to operate.
And social policies that allow you to operate and so on and so forth.
All right, so let me ask you a question. All right, so you deal with this situation that you just talked about, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very possible lawsuit that you brought it because you're nonprofit, doesn't mean. All right, so as a communicator now, when the news media comes in and so on, are you an advocate for the position that your hospital is not responsible, or what do you
think?
Hello,
we are. That's not clear to me.
Oh, well, see, I think there's a standard rule on that. I think we've all learned. Whenever you're involved in anything like this, and anyone comes to you, first of all, you say, wait a minute. Let's not talk about who's responsible. Let's first just spend a little minute thinking about what has happened and these people out here, you know, and this tragedy and so forth. That's what we've learned. Is that you got to focus people and show you care first. Then you'll go back to this other question.
Well, see, it never really got to that point. It may. I mean, who knows? Maybe there's a suit brewing, and as far as we know, there isn't. But the hospital is also tied by patient confidentiality. I wasn't there at the time, and there wasn't even the PR department is new. There's never been a public relations department. Brand new. And the person who responded to the press just said no comment, and wouldn't even confirm that the man had been a patient had been released within the past 24 hours.
I don't think that falls in the patient confidentiality.
Well, you get a lot of argument from that in the hospital community. Most hospitals would say that's right, that there's confidentiality here, and so we don't need to say that.
What would you suggest in that situation?
Well,
I mean, I know what I would do.
This is somewhat easy for me to answer. I mean, you may not agree with it because we've been through this probably 50 or 100 times, and that is that the first rule is that you focus on, you know, like when they came to Hooker at Love Canal, instead of saying, it's not our fault, you say, look, wait a minute, forget all that, whose fault it is, damn it, look at what we've got here. What can we as a company, what can we as a community do to help these people? So you first to show the care. Then you don't really want to admit you've done anything. If you've done something,
you don't know.
Different.
I mean, how can you know?
Let's just get it to the best. So as a communicator, you do that. But also as a good communicator, you won't find you know the second rule is that's the state one.
Yeah.
Second rule is you feel like this isn't going to die, you're going to have some more people come in for you. So the next thing you do is you go find out something about it.
Yeah, you find out about it as fast as you could. You know,
and what you find out? Mm-hmm. What you find out was that one of the employees came in the hospital who was responsible for that particular psychiatric center, misread a memo and released the wrong patient. Okay, it was this other patient that they were putting in.
That's totally different.
All right, so you find that out, because it does happen.
Sure.
I mean, this is the time, because we often find out the companies we represent do something wrong.
Sure.
Okay, now, but you've already said the other time. Now you're trying this out, okay? And now you get the additional inquiry. Why did you let this site go? There's forced on you another, what do you do?
That is, say what happened. It's human error. If possible, you should try not to say who did it. Because, you know, it's not up to you.
It could have been anyone.
Of course, it can happen to any human, and the better is he bad man. And you want to scapegoat, fire the person, and say, well, that's over. And I think that's on it.
That's what I asked. Is it basically they realized they were fault, and I got to say they were fault?
They said they were fault. It's the only thing you can do.
That is, if you tell the hospitals responsible, there's no question that I would advise putting it out there. The next one is that when you inquire, you find out that there was a release on purpose, but the psychologist who did the review was a guy who had some questions about it. In fact, There was already an inquiry going on internally within the hospital, and it's peer reviewed about this guy. Now, that doesn't mean that he might, he might have been the guy who may turn out that peer review turns out bad, but in this case, he evaluated it properly and it did. Okay. Now, when the inquiry goes on, but there's a question in that. When you find this out, and there's serious question in your mind, okay, as to whether or not the hospital operated a problem. Not one question.
Well, that's relatively easy, too. In the sense that, look, peer review is a continuing thing in medicine today.
Do you tell?
No, I would never mention that. He's undergoing peer review for something like that. I'd say everybody undergoes peer review every couple of years.
Because you're ending up scapegoating.
And the organization, the one thing organizations have to learn is that when you think you've scapegoated, all you've done is make it worse. Because then they wonder, well, he may be all right, but how about him? You see, the other thing you've got going for you in this case, I said that society sets the tone, is that society has set a very purposeful policy turned into legislation and regulations that we will take mental health patients out of the institution and put them back in society. Mm-hmm. And here's your hospital doing it. Thought they had, you know.
What is the problem by going, I mean, if I were in your shoes and the TV cameras could show up and rolling, I guess in my experience, I would go before them, hopefully supportive management, and say that we are appalled and shocked and saddened by what happened. We extend our sympathies to everyone involved. We want to express some concern. You know, we believe that our hospital provides the best available mental health care that we are able to provide, that our practitioners involved in this particular case provided
the best care, the relations, not ethics. Well, all right, but no, wait, there are things you need not know for certain, and it sounds defensive. You're about to say the care was good. You don't know that. Well, I would research it first to make sure that there wasn't a major error, but even then you might say something like our reputation for providing this kind of care, our history. We've handled 42,000 cases, you know, and I mean we feel badly about this, and this is just human life. Things happen.
Can you make a comment like we provide the best care that we know how? And we make judgment calls based on the best information we have at the time.
I really can't tell you a lot about this. If you're not familiar, there are these laws about release of psychiatric information, about patient confidentiality. We are bound by these. Certainly any of you, and then you do the old Reagan business. Certainly any of you that ever are in here or have any relatives are in here, you wouldn't want to sneeze in that information about your families, or God knows.
And that's a good report to go and find out.
Sure. That's how Reagan handled it, essentially handled Iran.
Mm-hmm.
When he went before the country, you know, just when it looked like he was going to finally say, I had something, did something wrong here, something wrong happened, he kind of fucked over it, and then he says, and now he says, let me just say to all of you out there who are families of those poor hostages, so what the hell are you going to say after he calls, you see, for us all to feel bad for these families? Are you going to zap him then? No, you just go away and leave it alone. That's what I'm going to do.
But is it fair for the hospital to go on the record making a claim that the hospital can't be responsible for people's behavior once they leave the door?
Sure, sure.
I mean, that's...
Okay. Sure. But would you want to do that? What would that buy you?
It looks like now my
eye. Yeah, in perception, I'm not sure what it would buy you. But I think that...
2,000 years ago.
I think you can talk about the law of release of information and talk about social, you know, it's a social policy, which, of course, we didn't set, which is going along with it. Far more. The phrase... that they, you know, these patients will be released back into society. And if anything, you might even want to defend that. I think strategizing it, I might defend the policy. See, so if they wanted to attack, they would attack the policy, and we've shifted it right over here to a debate on the policy of releasing patients back into society, and the issue has drifted away. That is known as blanketing, and these guys are expert at it. They're even trained in law school how to do that. We're not trained.
I thought they were born that
way. You
know? I really am. But that's not fine. Okay, what you're saying.
You mean that you're not
trained? In fact, the job that, the very job that, that John and I have at the office, the very job that we've got when we go into a company, is to, in the wider store, compare perspectives. If anything, the danger of what we do is that arrogance is going the other way.
Yep.
It's to go in and try to ferret everything out we can.
Yep.
And try to disclose it. And if ever we err, I'm going to say we err a lot of times, but when we do, that most of the time we err not in terms of blanking over it,
I was thinking of jury practice, you know, where you don't want to talk about the smoking gun, you're not talking about
that. That's the adversary side. That's the lighter side. That's the communicating after
the fact. There's something very interesting that happened with me that I think, you know, dealing with. If I were a communicator, the first thing I'd ever look at, I mean, I relatively new to the profession, is what are the ethics here? We were involved in one, a transition that's now going on while Monsanto is dropping these contracts to make parts for nuclear weapons, which is another ethical issue. And companies coming in who are going to bid on a contract and talking to management people like me about what we did and you know, how we viewed our jobs and all that sort of stuff. And of course, a lot of our former employees were consulting with these companies. And I'll name them right out. Generous Dynamics was one of them.
Oh, yeah, small ways.
Our former directors who, by the way, had left for ethical reasons, was consulting with them. And so I called him up and I said, I've got three questions for you. And the first one was, what are their ethics? And he very candidly said to me, now it's high standards, not standards. Well, that's something that you've got to know up front if you're going to go to work for somebody today in this job.
Yeah.
In this job. You really got to know that, especially if you're in that business.
Hmm.
Because I'll tell you, during the days of the Atomic Energy Commission, things were so paternalistic, it's one that didn't ruin half the world.
That's right. Well, and that's what we face every day at Los Alamos. There were, at almost every major installation, there were serious explosions and spills during that period. One hopes that the scientific data is correct, that all of that has worked itself through, because it's been years and years and years. But is it? I mean, I don't know. But would it do any good now for us to run around saying, oh, my God, and, you know, the British are just now admitting, as you know, about their 57 explosions.
Mm-hmm.
And it never ends.
Well, I think you've got to know that. I mean, that's one of the reasons we wanted to put together this session, is that for some reason or other, it doesn't seem to be very topical today. I mean, the Franco thing came through and flew by like nobody's business, and I'll stand there wondering what the hell happened. I mean,
yeah.
It was a shame.
But you know, ethics and business was a very hot topic during the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I used the foreign bribery situation. But during the period of time when the SEC took an entirely different view than they take today in terms of what was material, It was a very hot topic. So it's easier for lawyers, quite frankly, to deal with things then, because you had, you know, you just wave your hand, you said, now look, those guys are going to get you. And of course, they did get 175 companies or whatever in a 6-month period.
Yeah.
And so people really believed it. But, you know, often, that's kind of a good way for this thing to develop, but often it takes, may take government sometimes on occasion to be the stimulus, but it can have a real dramatic effect. It did. I mean, we buried it out all sorts of places. I mean, there was, people didn't think about domestic violence, but they do now. Okay? They may not find it. Okay? But they did for a period of time. They were scared of it. And, you know, that's, after all, it's the wrong reason. You should do the right thing for the right reason. But on the other hand, sometimes the change in atmosphere, people do it for whatever reason. They get accustomed to doing it right, and it turns into the right reason.
Yeah. Well, very, very interesting, different approach to this. Well, sometimes it's so easy for us, falsification of data, kickbacks,
graph,
out the door. But when you get into things like drug abuse, and you're getting real shady areas where you're, you know, it is not an overt act, perhaps by an employee, somebody caught on drug trip. And then the other factors enter in our case, classification and national security and that sort of stuff, which in itself is on a swing fire, you're right. I mean, way out there. So, you know, it'd be nice if everything were cut and dry and so easy as that.
So what's that? I mean, here's an interesting little. What's that if the CFO decides to allow his daughter to ride on the company planes to and from college?
Sure. Which is a hot issue.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's that.
I mean, that's a little shades of gray, but that's a standard.
Well, the interesting thing is here, though.
Well, I think a lot of companies.
No.
Well, but.
A lot of companies now have CEOs paying for their own personal use company airplane.
Absolutely. And under the new tax laws, that's going to even get worse. But then think for a minute of media, for example, just the simplest possible example. I mean, most of the standard good media, as you know, will not take your trip now without paying for it. Many of them will not come to the opening of your show for the tickets you sent. They will send you a check for the tickets. And I think that that's an interesting development, because they're the greatest freeloaders probably of all time. Yeah.
You've got to remember, though, that 10, 12 years ago, they wouldn't take your lunch, but that's really stupid.
Yeah, that's right.
What you could buy for lunch you never wanted anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Then to finally come back to perspective, a junket, and some junkets are just, you know, they're trash.
Oh, yeah. Well, pick up, though, on the point you made about it's the public interest. How about now along come maybe some legislation even about plant closings and about how you treat people, and that's kind of a downsizing. I know that management group is going to, you know, go through the roof, and oh my God, management prerogative, which has to be the dumbest phrase in the world. Whenever management says that, most of us, and I feel, I think, know we got a problem right off. But how do you resolve that now in terms of ethics?
Basically punitive.
That's
what
right.
You're not running your company responsibly.
That's right.
It's a punitive act.
That's right.
Despite how the government might screw up the economy, right?
That's right.
Government does that, after all, represent society as a whole. A company represents its own interests and that of shareholders. So it's not a bad rule in Europe.
No, it's not a bad rule in Europe because they have a mixed economy.
Yeah.
The question is here, you know, how are we gonna respond?
Well, sometimes companies does not necessarily represent the shareholder, but
but the man is.
But the increasing awareness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I
think in the US.
You bet.
There's an interesting parallel that kind of talks about what is the public good and dealing with the difference of the two cultures. I thought it was an interesting article once in the Fortune Ford following the crash of the Delta flight in Dallas, and within about 2 months, the Japanese airline crash that happened. And the parallel between the responses of the companies, that Delta communication at the time was confused, chaotic, there was no clear communication, the handling, the families were right there at the window, saw the plane crash, saw it go up in flames,
The Delta people immediately crowded them into a room, kept them there without information, kept them confused and uncertain. So they were kind of mistreated. Within, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact facts, but within 36 or 48 hours, the first lawsuits began to be filed, and there had been several hundred lawsuits related to that. The parallel was the president publicly apologized to the employer and resigned in shame. The company paid for all of the funerals and compensated even without any kind of litigation, worked with all the families, and there has either been no litigation involved or like minimal.
Well,
it's so different.
Well, but then, you know, after all, they took the risk.
Mm-hmm.
But see, that's an interesting case in another way, in that of all the airlines, I think most observers would agree that Delta, over time, has probably had the most enlightened policies. I mean, they have a no-layoff policy. They really believe in their employees. Everybody's job description in the company has a paragraph on their responsibility for building public relationships. You are encouraged to squeal on the guy working the counter next to you who's nasty with a customer. Not to be punitive, but so that someone can take me aside and say, look, are you having a bad day? Because remember, I mean, those are the people that pay our paychecks, and their public relations people have not been able to crack the legal department in that case, because what they're really doing, I was involved in a Delta crash in Boston in
1973.
Well, they put blankets over the name of the plane and all that stuff, but within 18 hours, I was called to come to this meeting of Delta, and the implication was clear that they wanted to talk and be helpful. Talk and be helpful, my eye. They had everybody out in the bullpen, and one by one, they sent you into the lawyers. Well, fortunately, some of us saw right through that. And so I knew that instead of them having an advantage over me, I now had an advantage over them. And my lawyers and I, you know, hit them where it hurt quick and got the dough right now, because we were about to reveal what they were up to. That was just another trump in our hand. And the poor people who didn't know, but the average Joe and Jane, they didn't know that. And 6 years later, they were still trying to get their money, because the rule in that field still is, sure, you know you're going to have to pay, but first you want that money put aside in an account which earns enough to pay what you got to pay. And isn't that funny? See, here's this company that has this wonderful view, and yet on that subject, clearly there is no ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is it them? Is it their insurance carrier? It's, you know, it's probably all of them, isn't it, together?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it gets back to, in that particular case, it gets back to an ultimate ethical question of what is the price tag on human life?
Mm-hmm.
I find it extremely interesting, just kind of two unrelated comments, but just kind of throw it in the hopper in regards to that. Guy here who was from Union Carbide said, we had to go public and give nasty messages that people didn't necessarily want to hear, but the fact of the matter is, life in India has less of a price tag associated with it than life in America. That's a fact. It's just if you're going to compensate what someone's, the guesstimate of their yearly salary or whatever, it's going to be very different.
Was that what they used, the wrongful death approach?
What is human life worth? One of the here in Texas, when the little girl got stuck in the well, and all these companies stuck her, they were doing sent drilling equipment and Federal Express sent it all up, and it was. Afterwards, somebody estimated that there were $17 million, I'm pulling that from the air, it was at least that or maybe more, that was spent to bring an 18-month baby out of the well.
Which would have...
But it's interesting that people were willing, and that's trying to estimate the man-hours that were donated, the material and the equipment that was donated.
It would have fed all the Vions and Sonora for...
Well, but if the same thing happened in India, and I expect the response to be very similar, the cost of that would be the same as these. And the kick. So,
quite great.
But it's interesting.
But that grabs you, because this is a life that you are being forced to witness, either being lost or being saved.
Yes.
And that has a grab on us that is 50 times greater than a death which is in fact that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's done, it's unwatched.
It's not personalized.
It's not personalized, right.
And it's kind of an interesting, like, you know, I don't have any answers or observations just beyond it sometimes amazes me of the different price tags.
Mm.
And a lot of it does become down to personalized our values. I mean, that ethics in essence are values.
But I think so often on a day-to-day basis, we get swept up in the event and we don't stop for the moment to analyze what we're doing. Instead, you know, again, it's our problem with being an advocate or the opposite thereof, being on our role at the time of something. And, you know, it does need to be something to get back to where you started. Every once in a while, you need that reminder or that head knock to stop, think about what you're doing, and then protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, in your, as I said, I'm going to give you a lot of categories tomorrow, but one of them is utilitarianism as a function, which is a different one than we knocked around a lot today, and particularly if you look at economic utilitarianism, where you have people making decisions about the use of money in your business, for example, and it won't show up in a direct way because what it'll mean is the resources are not made available, and so the death will occur, but it will be an indirect one, but you're making ethical decisions that are there nonetheless. And in some ways, that's even more distasteful to a lot of people. You get a lot of anger about that kind of economics from people. And you can start reading those where they'll say, if we deal with this particular illness that relates to people over 70 in this kind of way, it's going to cost us X, or we're not going to do it. Tricks. And, you know, and those are going to be governmental decisions.
Those
three eyes.
Yeah.
That's true.
British don't buy dialysis if you're over 60 or whatever.
Yeah. So those are issues that I think the director is going to relate to.
Well, the AIDS patient is such a good example of that.
Yes.
Because inevitably they're going to die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many heroic, pardon me?
But see, if you look at this whole triage issue, and we're going to shut the machines away, don't give you a machine after you're 65, then, I mean, do we have any role in the really larger ethical question here? A great deal of the cost of keeping people on dialysis is the people who develop the machines and who run them and who charge prices that are unconscionable. We've been through this one twice. They are unconscionable. And I have this great big picture of the guy in Canada, remember, who discovered insulin and who gave it to society. Didn't get a penny for it because it was going to help mankind. And now somebody doesn't even invent. They build the dialysis machine and set up these dialysis centers, and they're making profits, some of them, at $1,200, $1,500 a year on that stuff. And patients can't get out of it and can die. Do we, as representatives of our profession and of maybe the medical community, if that's what we're employed, do we have a role in pushing against that kind of a system, or is really money
bottom line?
Well,
or if you didn't have that kind of money in those professions, would you attract the kind of minds to those areas that would develop things like
this? Well, you know, the funny thing is on that one, I feel pretty good on that one, because that's always the American argument. People will only go into it for the money. And if you look at the great scientific discoveries of the world, they have all been made by people who were 10 times more interested in making that discovery, in, you know, helping, in whatever their motivation was, instead of having a huge big bang.
You can't just have one great big expert. You've got to have four brain surgeons. You've got to have 27 internists. You do two of the same.
Oh, yeah, I understand.
Getting involved with hospital costs. Really, I am interested. A lot of that. That's where your communication, your relationship with the community.
That's probably your biggest ethical issue.
It's a big what?
That's your biggest ethical issue, probably.
It's hospital costs, yeah.
Communication.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, the question is, you know, the value of human life. I also just brief aside and talking about AIDS patients, where they're right, it is a death sentence, and there is a whole system paid for the care. Is the care, in fact, even really warranted? If you're talking about someone who's going to die anyhow,
And I do believe that probably one of the greatest issues facing the healthcare industry is going to be the development, or society will have to decide about euthanasia.
Well, that's already on the agenda.
Yeah, and giving people the option to take the little white pill and choose their own death in a home setting.
Okay, now you're talking about 100% cure rate. What about a 2% cure rate for lung cancer? Do you not
well, I think it's
going to be But how about then another approach? Suppose you work for an insurance company. Mike Dukakis, like him, I lump him as a national candidate, finally gets a bill through one of the houses in Massachusetts that indeed there will now be health insurance for the uninsured. Okay, and by the way, when you work that out, it's a hell of a lot cheaper to pick it up that way than it is to pay after the fact, see? And the insurance company says, wait a minute, our business, that's our premium income. You've got to kill this in the Senate. And so you kill it in the Senate. And so there are still 600,000 people in Massachusetts without health care. See, now, is that an ethical issue for those insurance people, or was that okay for them because it was their box, it was their income? You see? I mean, I don't know. I think it's an ethical, personally, I think it's kind of an ethical issue. But I don't know. That's all it was only. Well, that's right. It's only they aren't getting any premiums from them now. It's only 10% of the population. The other people are still going to have to keep buying the policy from them. You see, because you got to, you know, be in a situation where you qualify for this. You see, and yet somehow they felt so threatened by that that they put on this full court press and denied these people that kind of coverage.
Their view is this government involvement? Is this socialism, and they see it not so much
the
single issue, but they look at the
flow question. Yeah, but then you have to ask that question, is that really what they mean, or has this just become this wonderful frosting that we always put over our own selfishness? Oh my God, it might be socialistic.
But you can't
look into
selfishness, and I keep coming down to the notion that
regulated, and they all say, look, we're regulated, and we're allowed a rate of return. That rate of return, and the whole philosophy of rate regulation is that that's the rate of return that's necessary to attract capital to maintain and then to build the necessary systems. Well, and that's supposed to be the minimum number, not supposed to be any extra. And the communicators, which do terrible job, they come on TV, they say that, and they say, and therefore, we're not willing to pay, or to spend with the $8 that we're asking someone pay
for the block. My parents just told me don't have that number on danger of losing your life.
Well,
but is that great?
Well, I'm in a conflict of interest here because those baby bells are crying.
No, in fact, our position for them is that on the 956, it isn't the $8. Our position is you're stupid not to just shut the damn number off. You know what it takes for them to shut the number off? A guy goes. That's all it takes, and that if they want to fight that issue, they should fight that issue on the First Amendment.
Yeah, but they don't get the $8. Their position is, look, we're getting the bare minimum. What's necessary for us to get capital.
Yeah.
If we don't get that $8, if we calculate we're going to get so many $8, okay, in our rate case to determine what our return is. Then we're not going to be able to attract enough capital.
But what they're saying is, therefore, stockholders over the public and the customers, and I find that very dangerous.
No, that's not what they're saying.
Well, they certainly are. You're talking about attracting capital. You're talking about benefiting the stockholders because they won't give you their capital unless they get a return.
That's the point. What they're saying, I'm not really agreeing with you on personal, but the argument is that, look, if they don't attract capital, sure, they can't provide the service. So they're saying, really, and their argument, and there's a logic to it, their argument is that we're benefiting all the customers.
Sure.
If you don't have customers, you're giving it.
What? You think that's bad? Wait, the next rising issue. The next rising issue in telephonics is rural service.
Okay.
See, it's not the idea anymore that we have universal service for everybody. You live out in the country, your bill is $1,800 next month to have a phone. Well, I mean, wait a minute.
Something's got, by the way, the real danger to this, you know, in the cell phone business is that whenever an independent economist has ever looked in the United States for any state regulatory commission at any telephone company, they have found that they are usually making, in fact, at least 1.5 to 2 times the supposed legal rate that the commission has granted them. And I tell them, don't push this upstream, because at some moment, somebody is going to let you.
But anyway, they're getting, so they get more capital, so they provide a better service.
Do that.
Doctors make a lot of money, but if we don't have the doctors that provide the health that make that kind of money, we'll only have the service. Of course, the countries that have socialized medicine say that the people ask them, but they don't.
You know, well, that depends on where you go. Cool. Canada will tell
you. But the rates of the affluent doctors is relatively maintained.
Well, and under that, it's a very fast disappearing. Right. The people who are coming now to medical school are no longer being attracted by the bucks.
Yeah.
We are apparently getting, and you know, we've got a real problem in the hospitals that we represent in both the Southwest and in New England, not in other parts of the country yet. And that is that the docs that are going there, don't talk to them about getting Mercedes and working on weekends and going nights. I moved here, damn it, so I can go skiing. If right now at 5 o'clock, I'm out of here. You know, I'll be back Monday at 9.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's totally
reversed.
But even if they could, they probably couldn't get the right to get started and say, you know, a lot of doctors, you know, we need
competition.
The drive for men in this city.
It's everywhere.
Now, meanwhile, it is 5 after 5, so I don't remember. I think it's
5:15.
Yeah,
we're going to wrap it up here.
I'm sorry.
All I'm going to say is tomorrow I'm going to take some of what you did for Grist for the Mill and add to that, as I said.
You really want us to think about these 6 questions?
I really do.
Yeah, this one, the personal ethics.
I thought it before.
Yeah, personal ethics is interesting.
And look forward to those of you who plan to be back. I'll see you in the morning.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Good.